Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Good evening and welcome to the New Year's Day edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, with my in-studio partner, Greg Priddy.
Good evening. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Same to you. How's Greg this evening?
Doing very well, thanks.
Yeah? Okay. Did you go for your ride?
Absolutely. I rode on Friday and just a little bit today.
Well, I think the weather's going to take a turn for the worse here, so I hear.
It's going to be sunny but cool tomorrow. But
cool? I think they're saying like 27. That's
warm enough.
Okay. Warm enough. Never mind. All right. Well, I know a lot of people use the new year as a chance to look back and ponder how the year unfolded for them, although I tend to do that at the autumn equinox and then use January 1st as a day to look forward. In 2010, bicycling had a particularly good promotional year, ranging from hundreds, if not thousands, of articles and posts about every possible aspect of our bicycle world. We've seen legislation to promote cycling in one form or another on all levels, local, state, and national. We've gained and lost support from those at high levels, including the Secretary of Transportation, who almost daily posts something positive about bicycling and pedestrian issues. We've seen the competitive arena expand in the U.S. with the new Fondo concept, while watching the appalling continuation of cheating at the elite levels. But what is most heartening to me is that the bicycle is once again becoming fashionable. It's cool, it's green, and it's fun to ride your bike. So as I look forward in 2011, I'm expecting to see more expansion of our goals. Kids on bikes, adults on bikes, more tolerance among those on the roads, and a general acceptance of bicycling as important to the future of our way of life. My New Year's resolution is to keep promoting bicycling whenever and wherever I can. So with all that said, we have a bit different show for you tonight. Greg requested that we do this, so I have consented. Our guest tonight is me, and the interviewer is Greg. So I will now turn the microphone over to Greg, and I hope you enjoy the show.
Me interviewing anyone, Diane, is scary on a lot of levels.
Oh, no, it's going to be perfect. You decided to do this.
I hope you're not as nervous as I am.
You'll be fine.
Yeah. So we kind of started this back in September.
Right.
And just charged into bringing on these great guests and interviewing them. And perhaps listeners don't know that much about you, actually. We know a lot about your guests, and we've gleaned a little bit along the way, but thought maybe it was time after a dozen or so shows to give everybody more of a formal introduction and a little bit background on who's bringing them this show every week.
Well, okay. That's okay. It was supposed to be this best-kept secret, but I guess we're going to unveil it now.
Well, only as much as you want to reveal,
obviously.
Of course.
No, I appreciate that.
So my other radio colleague here at the station, Dr. Akande, has a Wednesday show, and she always starts her interviews with a very simple, basic question. What has your journey been like? And people take that in all kind of different directions. But so I guess that is the question I would pose to you to at least kick this off. Kind of where were you born, where you grew up, and we'd like to know what you did before you got into the bicycle business.
Okay.
And then, kind of a recap of, where you've been in terms of cycling, and we'll go from there.
So. Okay. Well, I was born in Philadelphia.
Uh-huh.
And my family moved to Cincinnati, where my maternal grandmother lived. And so in an effort to make sure she had the proper care, my family was there. My mother's sister and her brother were still there. So I grew up in Cincinnati, which we affectionately called Stinkinati. It's not my favorite place, although it's a wonderful town. I found it to be somewhat stifling, and I don't know if it was because my family was there or because, in fact, it's a very conservative town.
It is very conservative, that's for sure.
Right.
Yeah.
And of course, it's right across the river from Kentucky. And it's also very hot and very humid.
That's for sure. Yeah. I lived in Lexington for a couple of years.
Uh-huh.
And I can attest
so
to the
understand.
Heat and humidity. Yeah.
Right.
But, you know, generally nice people.
Oh, yeah. I think they're nice people everywhere you go. You know,
sure.
That's part of it, of just living in a community. So I went to grade school and high school in Cincinnati. Graduated from Woodward High School, which is in, I don't know, the Bond Hill, Roselawn area, for anybody who knows that area. And then hoofed up to Columbus to Ohio State for a couple of years. And didn't really like it for a variety of reasons, which we don't need to go into. But I ended up coming to Northeast Ohio, to Cleveland, to go to art school. I spent the summer of my... would have been sophomore to junior year in college. So I had turned 18. So I was a little young to be in college to begin with.
Mm.
And so going into Ohio State with 9,000 other freshmen was more than a little daunting.
And it's a big school.
It is a big school. And actually the first year I was there was the year they burned the hole in High Street because novice G. Fawcett, who was at the time, I think, president of Ohio State, would not let the football team go to the Rose Bowl. So we actually had the first campus riot, as far as I can remember. And I don't want to tell you what year that was. It was a long time ago.
Okay. So but where did you go to school?
I went
here?
To Cooper School of Art, which is no more. But at the time, it was a very popular commercial art school.
Okay.
And I learned a lot about commercial art. I mean, you still took a lot of standard art classes like life drawing and painting and those kinds of things. But in addition, you got to do things like airbrush mm-hmm. and perspective and doing ads. And it has served me very well over the years.
Sure.
I actually didn't graduate. Other things got in the way. I got married. I had a baby 6 years later, a girl who is now going to turn 39 this month. So she's way past being a little girl. And she's still here in Northeast Ohio with her husband. She's a teacher.
So how did you make
the
leap
transition
from art school, commercial art, to bike shop?
My daughter's father was in the art school, too. And so one of us had to work. One of us had to go to school.
Uh-huh.
He was much more talented as an artist and still is to this day. He's a terrific artist. He happens to live now in Eugene, Oregon, or somewhere out there on the West Coast. And as things began to deteriorate between my daughter's father and I, or and me, here comes the grammar police, look out. I stayed in Cleveland and he moved to the West Coast and I needed a job.
Sure.
And we had a friend who owned a bike shop.
Okay.
And I went to work for him.
Okay. And what was that for?
It was called LBS Bicycles.
Here in Cleveland?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. What?
It was at 49th and Memphis on the west side.
Okay. So that's obviously not around any longer.
Well, LBS was around for a long time, actually. Mm-hmm. So it moved from 49th and Memphis over to Broadview Road between Pearl and Spring.
Okay.
And so I started there in 1974, and it closed in February of 1989.
Okay.
So 15 years, I got my feet more than wet. They were like ground in cement for 15 years. And I spent, I would say, the first 2 years, absolutely every minute that I could, I spent watching the person who owned the shop at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Do everything that he did. And he was an excellent mechanic. He is no longer in the business, but he taught me a lot. And I just sucked it all in. I have no idea why. I am not one of those people who, as a child, said, when I grow up, I'm going to be. I never did that.
Mm.
I just sort of let life unfold, and it unfolded itself right into the bicycle. I fell in love with the bicycle, and I've never looked back.
So who was the owner of LBS?
His name was Vince
okay.
Romano.
Okay.
I think he's still around. He's no longer in the business. But he was a great mechanic.
Yeah. And what were you doing in this shop?
I learned a Presta from a Schrader tube.
Okay.
I eventually took over the business side and a lot of the sales
mm-hmm.
and just began to expand the vision of the shop and eventually took it over. And he went his way and I went mine. Mm-hmm. That shop closed in, as I said, in February of 89. And then... City Bike opened.
Okay, and I vaguely remember City Bike. This was downtown,
right? It was downtown. We took, this is an interesting story, actually. I think this is more interesting than almost anything else up to this point. Although, I will say that LBS became one of the first top 100 shops in the country for several years. Hmm. And I also had the opportunity to become a contributing editor to Bicycle Dealer Showcase, which was the trade journal, the biggest trade journal at the time. It was owned by Harcourt Brace Jovanovich, I think.
Sure, yeah.
Which was in Middleburg Heights at the time. They had a facility here, and all the BDS people were transferred to Cleveland.
Okay.
So I got to meet them all, and they became really, really good friends. We stayed friends. We're still friends. Molly and Walt Jarvis was the publisher at the time, and Molly Trudeau, who actually met her husband here in Cleveland and became Molly Trudeau, because I can't remember her maiden name anymore. It was like a way long time ago. But at any rate,
So back to City Bike.
Back to City Bike. So we had this opportunity to take a place in the warehouse district, which was on, it was on West 6th Street between Superior and St. Clair. And it, I don't think there had been a new retail in the warehouse district of Cleveland for years and years. Sure. And years. I mean, at that time, there was still an adult store on the corner.
Sure, yeah.
And catty corner to that was the City Mission.
And they were just starting to convert those buildings to residential on
right.
the upper floor.
You had
so
the
really,
Hat Factory, and yeah. you had down at the corner, you had the, I don't remember what that place was, where they put all the lofts upstairs. Mm-hmm. Fat Fish Blue became the restaurant in the bottom.
Before they moved to the Gateway
Before
District.
They moved to
wow.
Gateway.
Yeah, so downtown was a very different place then.
Very different. And in fact, there was no, at the time, Jacobs Field, which is now Progressive Field. Yeah. They hadn't built that yet. And we still had the old stadium on the lakefront.
Yeah.
So we took this ancient building and we renovated it. Well, you have to deal with, because it was a historic building in what was called the Johnson Block, you had to deal with what we called the Architectural Review crazy people.
Yeah.
They are
certain things
nuts.
You can't do.
Oh, and we didn't. We restored the tin ceilings. We restored
I remember that.
The beautiful, beautiful diagonal hardwood floors. We had this ascending staircase that went up to where we put offices. It was stunning. It was one of the most beautiful stores ever. Ever.
So you were the owner of this, or
well,
co-owner?
Well, no, I was not even the co-owner. I was the manager of the store.
Okay, all right.
Everybody thought I owned the store. No.
You only acted like you owned
the
store.
That's correct, because I just come in and take over. But it became very popular. The problem with City Bike was really Cleveland.
Yeah.
That Cleveland could not find a way to support its downtown businesses. We had hoped that the warehouse district would become this sort of gentrified neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And it never happened. You know, we needed a grocery and a dry cleaner and a drugstore. And we needed all the things that people would need to live and work downtown.
You were just a couple miles too far to the east.
Not even a couple
and about
miles.
10 mile, and about 10 years too early.
That's more like it.
Because it all happened in Tremont and Ohio City.
It did.
Yeah.
It did.
Yeah, but
it
you had the concept.
Right. It became a place for galleries and restaurants
yeah.
and parking for the Jacobs Field and then the stadium. Huh. It was all about nightlife, really. And basically, the people who would come and shop, they, you know, forget that. Cleveland rolled up its shopping street, you know, at sidewalks at 5:30 in the evening.
Yeah.
So somebody came along and wanted to buy it.
The business?
The business. They wanted it just the way it was, and we said, see ya. And I then...
Did they continue in that location
for a
while?
They did for a while.
And then they...
They...
Didn't make it.
It went away.
Yeah.
Yeah. And right. I think appropriately.
Huh. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist, and the host, of course, is Diane Lees, and our main interview guest this week is also Diane Lees on 88.7 FM WJCU and WJCU.org. So where did you go in your bicycle nomadic existence after City Bike was sold?
Well, you know, I sort of rattled around a little bit, and we used to put on an event at City Bike called the Touring Open House, where we would invite four or five tour directors, people like Backroads and Classic Adventures and all kinds of people who put on these bike tours, Experience Plus, all over the world. And we'd invite four or five of the tour directors into City Bike And in the meantime, collect just tons and tons and tons of literature from people all over the world who offer tours.
Mm-hmm.
And at one of these events, we were all sitting around in the evening talking, and I, of course, in my inimitable style, said, "So what's the biggest issue you guys have when somebody comes to take one of your tours?" And almost to a person, they said, "The people aren't prepared." I said, "Well, don't you send out departure guides?" "Oh, yeah." "Do they read them?" "Sometimes." So, you know, people are coming to these tours and perhaps have never ridden before, have ridden just a little bit. "Oh, I'm going to France." And they would come into the shop, you know, and they'd get their shorts and they'd get their shoes and they'd get their helmets and they'd get all their stuff. "How many miles have you had on your bike?" "25, 30.
Wow.
So I actually spent the next 8 months from the time City Bike closed until Hubbub came into existence,
mm-hmm,
writing a book.
Okay. And this was
called The Hubbub Guide to Cycling.
All right.
Which has a very interesting way that the title came about.
So this was what time frame, roughly?
So this was, let's see, City Bike closed 7 years to the day from when it opened. So this was June of 1996. And then at the end of September, I actually took out a vendor's license for Hubbub Custom Bicycles. At the time, it was just called Hubbub Bicycles.
Huh.
And began looking for space. It had to be within a mile of my house so that I could walk. That was the criteria.
And so you ended up on Taylor Road.
No, on Lee Road.
On Lee Road.
On,
yeah,
Lee Road, across from the Cleveland Heights High School track.
Oh.
In between Lusty Wrench and Heights Guitar. Oh, well, actually, there was also a recruiting, I think an Air Force recruiter next door, too. It's this kind of little...
Oh, I thought you were on Taylor for some reason.
We did. We moved
to
Taylor. Yeah, when the roof was leaking so badly on Lee Road, we moved to Taylor.
You were right there in the thick of it in the, you know, you're kind of a classic Heights business.
We were.
Anybody knows the Cleveland Heights area.
Right,
so,
right.
So started on Lee, moved to Taylor.
And then we outgrew the space, basically, because I became a yoga teacher. When my mom got sick, and she had a horrible disease. She had emphysema.
Mm.
And she did nothing to help herself, which was just pathetic. And I say this to anybody who is listening. If the doctor says get up and walk, get up and walk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you need to take responsibility for as much as you can do. And she decided one day she had nothing to live for. So guess what? She died.
Oh, boy.
Mm. And I, you know, it was one of those things. And I had spent most of my life doing exactly the opposite of what my mother wanted me to do. You know, you're going to do this? No, I'm going to do that. So in that regard, I made good choices for myself. And I, and Brian was a big part of this. He's, it was my, I don't know, 53rd birthday, maybe, around there. He said, "You know what? You've talked to me nothing but yoga for, you know, several years. Get back in the studio." And I did. And I spent the next year taking classes everywhere. And then the next, then I enrolled in a yoga teacher training and became a certified yoga instructor.
When did you originally start practicing yoga?
I started practicing it in my 30s and sort of let it go. You know, life gets in, you know,
sure,
it's like cycling.
Life gets
in the way and you come back to it. Well, it was a cycle and I came back to it. I don't think I'll ever let it go this time.
Well, that's good. It's a lifelong
habit. Way of life.
I
think yoga has a lot to offer on many, many, many levels. And boy, does it help cycling.
Well, we'll talk about yoga
in
a minute.
Okay.
So you wrote this book on touring.
Well, and how to take a tour.
How to take a tour.
Yeah.
What was sort of the process, or how did all of this crystallize into what Hubbub was going to become? Because Hubbub is not your typical bicycle shop. I've seen a lot of people walk into Hubbub, and they're very confused. They get a look on their face that says, "I thought I was walking into a bicycle shop. Now I'm not quite sure where I am." Requires some explanation.
It does.
So probably requires some explanation for our listeners, too, especially those not from around here who haven't been in the shop.
I guess if you were just going to fall through the door and have an expectation of it looking like a bicycle shop, you shake your head and look around and go, "What is this?"
Right, because there are no bicycles,
right?
Basically built and ready for you to
there
ride.
There are no stacks and stacks of bikes. There are no big lines of bikes or big rows of bikes.
And
no.
Some accessories and clothing, a modest amount, but certainly not what you'd expect if you went into a Century Cycles or an Eddie's or a Performance or anything like that.
Or any of your local regular bike shops anywhere.
Yeah, it's totally different.
So I guess we do need to backtrack a little bit. In 1984, which was still at LBS, I came across this device called a fitting cycle. And it was this funky, I can remember it was blue. If anybody has a pair of old Chinelli blue rollers, that's what it looked like.
Mm-hmm.
And so all it did was it allowed you to sit on it and pedal. You could change the length of the stem out and in, mm-hmm. and the height of the saddle up and down. And that was
it. That's it.
But it was my first introduction to fitting. And because I think a lot of it had to do with my art background and all the life drawing that I did, I could see somebody on a bicycle and see what was going on, why something wasn't working.
Mm-hmm.
So we began to build custom bicycles. Now, custom bicycles in the 80s and custom bicycles today are very, very different in terms of the process. But there were people back then building bicycles like Albert Eisentrout and Bill Boston and Doug Fadig and Ben Serrata,
mm-hmm.
were all building these handmade, beautiful custom bicycles, and I fell in love with them. Now, for a long time, I sold a lot of Italian bikes, like Gracciotti's and the Alans, and those. But we would do custom things to them. I would do fitting to make sure they had the right stem and the saddle was comfortable and all of that.
So they were stock frames.
They were stock frames.
From the Italian makers, but you were basically tweaking them with components and
making them more comfortable. Well, mm-hmm. when we moved into City Bike, we got a Serrata size cycle.
Okay.
And now we were actually being able to do things like change top tube length, mm-hmm. and seat angle. And you could change, all of the different and now you had clipless pedal systems. So now you're working with cleats, mm-hmm. in a much more professional way, and it has evolved. And so somewhere between LBS and City Bike, I wanted to do this idea of a fitting custom only studio,
mm-hmm.
and I got voted down. If there were 10 votes, there were 9 against me. If there were 20 votes, there were 19 against.
Who were you polling?
Well, the people who actually had the money for the businesses.
Okay.
Because it wasn't my business. Mm-hmm. So I had to go along with what I wanted to do. But when City Bike got sold, I did have some money at that point. And I said, if I ever do another bike shop, it's going to be custom only.
Right.
The industry just went nuts. They're saying, you can't do that. It's never going to work. You're going to be out of business in 2 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And on and on and on. The naysayers were endless. And everybody came in and tried to sell me Klein, because we were a big Klein dealer in those days, or whatever. And I almost capitulated, actually. I almost brought in a line of bikes. But Brian held my feet to the fire, and he was right to do that. And so today, Hubbub is exactly what we had said, custom only. Every single bike we sell is fit, designed, and built to order.
Interesting. So speaking of Brian.
Yes.
Brian's not from around here.
No, Brian's from upstate New York the beautiful Adirondacks.
And how did he get lured to Cleveland?
And it was, send that fish hook out there and see what would happen. So if anybody remembers way back at LBS and at City Bike, there was a gentleman who worked with me named John Lee. And he was the head of the technical department at City Bike. And he became the head of the technical department at LBS when I bought Vince Romano out.
Mm-hmm.
So he came along with me to Hubbub. And in the interim, interestingly enough, when I was writing my book, he went back to Case and finished his undergraduate degree. He had left for a variety of reasons, mm-hmm. and went back and only had 2 courses left to take. So he came back. He had finished it. His degree was in biomechanical engineering. And after being with me for 8 months, he walked in the store one day and said, I was offered a job in my field.
Hmm.
And I was like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
I am in deep trouble because the shop is predicated on this engineer being able to build these bikes.
Sure.
Even though I was doing all the fitting at the time, you know, somebody had to be putting these bikes together and deciding how they were going to be built. So there is a publication called the National Bicycle Dealers Association Newsletter, the Outspoken Newsletter, actually. I think it is called Outspoken. And you can, because if you're a member, you can take a free ad.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. And guess whose resume came through?
Brian's.
This young engineer, and he is a mechanical engineer,
mm-hmm.
Who has been in the bicycle business, had been then, I don't know if it was 5 or 6 years professionally, at a little shop in Johnstown, New York. And the criteria were that he could work with road bikes because, you know, mountain bikes were still big in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And I never got into mountain biking heavily, as in professionally in the bike shop. And that he could build wheels, and that he was a good wheel builder.
Uh-huh.
And he
those
met
those were
all,
your criteria.
Those were my criteria.
Okay.
And he, I think it was December of 97, he drove all the way out to Cleveland, spent 3 days, including working in the shop, and I had put together kind of these projects for him to
uh-huh.
do. Of course, he did them perfectly. I mean, he came up with all these great ideas. And then made him an offer and watched him drive away, and I'm going, oh, now what if he says no? And I mean, I was prepared for that as an eventuality, but he didn't. And I think it was Christmas Eve of 1997.
Back.
No, I got an email.
Oh, uh-huh.
And he said, I'll take the job.
Wow.
And the rest is, we say, it's history. He started in the end of January of 1998. And for the person, that would be me, who hadn't been on a bicycle in 18 years, he had me riding by April.
Wow.
He insisted that I get back on a bike. And a lot of people know.
Was that a tandem or a...
No, that was a single.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
A bike that actually I had Waterford designed, mm-hmm. called a Waterford Diva.
Okay.
It was a woman's bike.
So that was 13 years ago.
Yes, it was.
Hubbub started, and you managed
It'll
to
be 14
find...
on February 11th, Hubbub.
Ah, coming up.
Mm-hmm. The same day my book was published.
Huh.
February 11th.
Wow.
The store opened the same day. The store was originally predicated also on the idea that we would have all of the products that we talked about in the book as a companion catalog. And right about the time the book got published, things changed from having paper catalogs to all this online stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, paper catalogs are back. I mean, Colorado Cyclist still has a catalog,
sure.
Excel Sports, Performance Bikes,
yeah.
Bike Nash Bar. They still have paper catalogs. But I would venture to say that most people order online now.
Yeah.
And so then the price of direct mail went up, and things just changed. So we sort of canned the catalog idea. We still had all those products, and we expanded on the idea of the custom bike.
Yeah. We are going to take a short break for a station identification and a couple of messages, and we'll be back with more on The Outspoken Cyclist with our host and guest, Diane Lees, right after this.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
This entire piece of music was played with only two instruments, a right hand and a left hand. Hands can do incredible things, but nothing compares to using them to help save a life with hands-only CPR. If an adult suddenly collapses, call 911, then push hard and fast in the center of their chest until help arrives. Hands-only CPR is recommended by the American Heart Association, and it's incredibly easy and effective. Find out more about this latest method of CPR at handsonlycpr.org. The power to help save a life is in your hands. A message from the American Heart Association and the Ad Council.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Greg Priddy, and
I am Diane Lees.
And Diane is our one-hour guest this week, and so we continue on with more of conversation with Diane about all things bicycling and all things custom bicycles. And you've managed to find enough people who are, for one reason or another, not able to find cycling happiness on a stock frame.
Well, I have a philosophy. My philosophy is nobody is average.
Okay.
That when a bicycle manufacturer makes, say, six sizes available in a frame, let's say they make a 48 through a 61 centimeter.
And that's being generous these days because usually it's, what, three or four?
Well, it depends on the manufacturer. Yeah. I would agree. I mean, Giant got into the small, medium, and large and extra large idea, which, you know, never flew for me. And we'll talk about women's frames a little bit because I am also of the belief that women are no different from men. They just need something that works for them, and they need to be treated the same way men need to be treated. So it's important, in my opinion, that the bicycle is comfortable, that you can perform on it efficiently, and that you aren't getting off the bike and feeling like you've been dragged through the mud, unless you're on a mountain bike, I guess.
Yeah.
But you understand what I'm saying, that you should be able to ride long and hard and comfortably all day, every day, and be tired at the end of the day. But if your feet are numb or your fingers are numb or your back hurts or your neck hurts or your knees hurt, you're never going to be comfortable and happy on the bike. And so if you get the right bike to begin with, you should never have those problems. So, you know, our idea is every bike should be perfect. And it should be perfect from the moment you get on it. Now, having said that, 99% of the people will still buy a stock bike. And so we have services where we do refitting, where people come in and you've availed yourself of that service.
Sure, yeah.
Of refitting. Mm-hmm. But our custom bikes are quite unique. I would say we are one of only a very few shops in the country who has on staff somebody who can actually take the numbers off of our fitting machine and turn it into a frame from scratch. So we do not send numbers to a manufacturer.
Right.
We send a design, an actual drawing, an engineering drawing.
Yeah, and that is definitely, the listeners can kind of visualize in your head that what you end up with as a result of the fitting machine is some kind of contact points in space, really. And those need to be synthesized into a frame that can actually be built out of tubes.
Well, and not only that it works for your fit, but that the geometry works on the road.
Sure, because there's issues in handling and cornering and all of these things that, so it's a kind of, you know, you're optimizing for a lot of different parameters all at the same time.
And convincing somebody that we know what we're doing. Now, we happen to have now hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of frames out there. So that after 14
years. How many frames?
That's a really good question. I knew you were going to ask that question. I would say we don't build as many frames as we would like, of course. We would love to build more. Maybe 1,200.
Wow. That's a pretty good number.
It's not a bad number. Now, that does not include tandems. We do sell tandems. We actually have in store that's getting ready to be delivered a 100% custom design built tandem that's pretty remarkable. But for the most part, people like Commotion and DaVinci and Santana, who specialize in tandems, have been able to figure out a tandem formula for a captain and a stoker where we don't need to get involved with that too much.
Okay.
We have done some custom tandem work, but we sort of leave tandem handling up to them.
So backing up just a little bit, you made mention of something that nobody is average.
That's correct.
This sort of flies in the face of the conventional wisdom, which says, and a lot of the things I have read say, most people are average enough that they can be fit on a stock frame with some customization of seat post, bars, stem, some of the things that you can change about a bike without altering the structure of the frame. And obviously...
we disagree, to some extent.
But obviously people, thousands of people, far more people, numerically, are riding stock frames than custom frames.
Right.
And fairly successfully.
Yes. I won't disagree.
They're not all in pain. I ride two different stock bikes. And
they've been fitted.
They've been fitted, but so they didn't come directly off the shelf, but they certainly are not custom to me in the frame sense. And I enjoy them very much. I feel comfortable.
Right.
I've ridden, you know, double metric centuries on both of those bikes.
Okay.
So I'm trying to bridge the gap there between my experience and the experience of a lot of people and your philosophy and your experience.
Okay.
Where does that come together?
Well, and I'll try to explain it because it's very difficult to explain. It is a leap of faith if you're going to get a bike at our store, because you're never going to ride the bike that we designed for you until it's actually designed and on the road. So you have to understand, and we do have demos in the store, so you get the feel of what you don't like as well as what you do like.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of things like handling, acceleration, cornering, what we call vertical compliance, the comfort of the frame as the road noise is coming up through the tires and up through the frame. So all of those things can be somewhat tuned in. And I think if you think back to Richard's interview a couple of weeks ago, Richard Schwinn's interview, he talks about tuning his tubing to work. So here's what happens when you take a stock frame and start making changes. When a frame is designed, it's designed to ride a specific way. So let's assume for a moment that it's a 58-centimeter frame, which is a fairly average size.
Mm-hmm.
I think it translates to something like 22.8 inches.
That's what I would ride.
Okay. And then they're going to say, and we want you to have a 110-millimeter extension stem, and your saddle is going to be somewhere in the middle of the rails of a setback seat post.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I hope that makes sense to anybody who is listening. So you have a seat post that the saddle sits on the rails, and if you look at the actual post without the saddle on it, it's got this extension backward where the rails sort of fit in these notches. All right. Now, it has a specific top tube length. So it's a 58-centimeter frame. Let's say it has a 57.5-centimeter top tube. Maybe 58. Maybe it's a 58 square, what we used to call a 58 square, which is a very common frame geometry. And then you have a 73-degree seat angle, which is sort of neutral. 72 gets you into touring. 74 gets you into sort of racing and track. And 75 and 76 gets you into triathlon. So somewhere between 73 and 73.5 is road geometry.
This has to do with how...
the angle between the...
How relaxed and how vertical
steep.
The seat post or seat tube
seat
is.
Seat tube is.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. So we have a stock frame. Now, you get on it, and I find that, yes, your average height, let's say you're 6 feet tall, 5'11",
mm-hmm.
and you have, just for sake of argument, you have a 33-inch inseam.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can stand over this frame, which you never do when you're riding it, by the way. So standover is kind of one of those things that's just a starting point for us.
Yeah, yeah.
But there are a lot of people who say, oh, no, I need 3 inches of clearance. Well, you don't you don't ride the bike by standing over it. So you have to think about what it is you're really doing here. And then I sit you on that, or you sit on that bike, and I take a look at you, and I see that you are, as you're pedaling, you're way behind the crank. So now you're not really pedaling a circle. You're paddling the bike.
Mm-hmm.
Think about how you're behind the cranks, you're kind mm-hmm. of paddling. Or you're way over the crank, so now you're pistoning the bike.
Okay.
Your legs are going up, and you're not making a circle.
Okay.
Okay. But because the top tube is long, I have to push your saddle forward to make up for you being able to reach your brake levers.
Mm-hmm.
Or I have to shorten your stem a lot.
Yeah.
So as soon as you start fooling with things like shortening stems, you're changing the handling of the bike. Because
yeah.
a real short stem mm-hmm. makes it fidgety in the front, and you go downhill and you get a high-speed vibration, and it scares the hell out of you. But that's how you learn to ride that bike. Well, that's not optimum. So now you have this built-in fear of going downhill fast. Think
Maybe.
About it for a minute. Okay. Okay, now the top tube's too short because you got a small frame. So you shove the seat back. Now we're back to paddling the bike.
Yeah.
So all I'm trying to say is there is an optimum way to ride a bicycle.
Don't mean to pin you against the wall here, but I'm kind of taking the devil's advocate approach.
Of course you are.
And
that's okay. I appreciate it.
And, you know, a lot of people would say, well, of course, a custom bike costs, you know, a few thousand dollars. It's an expensive proposition. And most people, when they get it, you know, and finally ride it, they're... The bicycle version of the placebo effect takes over, and you would, of course, love a bicycle that
not
costs
necessarily.
That much. Really?
No, that's not how I look at it. Yeah. And I think it's an interesting point that you're making, but here's my experience. My experience is the person who finally gets to us has already been through two or three $2,000 bikes.
Okay. All right.
Okay, so, I spent $1,000 on the first bike. Nah, that didn't work. I spent $2,000 on the next bike. Well, now we're at $3,000. We are already 75% of the way there to the custom bike that you could have had if you had just... Now, I'm not saying people shouldn't take that opportunity to learn about cycling.
Right, because the money that people invest in those kind of starter bikes...
Right, and that's okay.
...definitely gains expertise and...
I don't disagree.
...sort of winnow out what you like, what you don't like,
right.
What you need... So second question along this line is, you've done custom fits and you do refits
all the time.
So, give me a number if you can quantify it in terms of how close to custom can you really get in a refit of a stock bike?
You some percentages.
Okay,
so. I can tell you that over the years, there have only been one or two people who we finally say to them, look, this is just never going to work. I don't care what we do, you are still going to have the problem you're having. Now, and that's really where the issue comes.
In terms of a refit.
In terms of a refit.
Okay, so pretty much everybody that's come in wanting a refit, with the exception of a few people.
Has a reason for it.
But you have been able to get them.
Comfortable.
Okay.
And it may not be optimum. And I can accept that. They've
sure.
accepted that.
Mm-hmm.
That is the agreement.
But there are a certain number of people that will never be right on anything.
We
but
won't
a full
be able
custom.
To fix the problem. So
yeah.
Here, you know, if you're coming into me and saying, I'm having this issue or that issue, and I'm able to resolve the issue. So I'm able to resolve your knee pain, your foot pain,
sure.
your shoulder pain, your hand pain. And it may not have done wonderful things to make the bike handle wonderfully, but you will accept less handling or less acceleration or whatever it is you're willing to accept for the comfort, because mm-hmm. you sure aren't going to be happy when your feet are numb when you're riding.
Yeah, no amount of performance
right.
or acceleration
right.
or handling is going to overcome on discomfort on the bike.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
okay.
exactly. So as soon as you hate your bike because every time you get on it you feel terrible, then we have to resolve those issues. There are certain people for whom there are no bikes. Take our 6'8" violist from the orchestra.
Right.
Or take my friend Susan in New York, who's 4'10" on a good day.
Yeah.
And so those people obviously need something
and
way out of the ordinary.
Yeah, I don't think nobody really contests that they need custom.
Right.
Yeah, I mean,
but it comes down to the person who, and I will say this, most people by the time they get to us have been through several bikes. Unless they are out of the parameters of a stock like 6'8" or 4'10",
mm-hmm.
most people have been through several bikes. Occasionally, somebody will come in and say, everybody I talk to says, don't waste your money. Just get the custom bike the first time, and I can afford it.
Yeah.
Now, Brian will give you, in his inimitable style, the economics of it. I look at it like, look, I want what I want when I want it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll wait until I can get what I want, and I won't compromise. And I did not ride a custom bike for a long, long time, until actually Brian built that Calfee tandem for us.
Mm-hmm.
That was the best riding bike I've ever been on. And it was somewhat stock as a tandem, but my fit is very, even though it might look ordinary, it's very particular.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be 100% comfortable.
Yeah.
I don't want to fight the bike. So Brian will tell you that if you buy a bike from us, and we can compromise things like who's building the frame. No, you do not need Sevens Axiom, which is their butted titanium frame, and it is expensive. But you could buy Seven's Resolute, and it's a steel frame. And because of the way we design it, and because of the parameters of things like vertical compliance and stiffness and handling, you can make it feel like a dream, and it still only weighs 17 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people get hung up on those few ounces of weight.
Yeah, and there, you know, I've ridden heavier bikes and lighter bikes and even lighter bikes, and there is a difference in feel.
Yeah, there is.
But it doesn't necessarily
change
translate.
Your tires.
Well, yeah, and it doesn't necessarily translate for most of us into actual, you know, performance benefits.
Right.
Because,
well, what do you want from the bike?
Well, but the point is that, you know, the bike weighs 20 pounds, the rider weighs 180 pounds.
And then he's going to go out for the full day and put a rack on the back with, you know, 12 pounds worth of food.
Well, even if not,
right.
the greater percentage, far greater percentage of the total rider plus bike package is the rider.
Right.
So if you want a lighter bike, get a lighter rider.
Well, there is that. We always talk about you want to take 5 pounds off the bike, drop some weight.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. But
and it's far cheaper, too.
It is cheaper. Well, it's usually healthier.
Yeah, yeah. So,
yeah. So that's the philosophy at Hubbub. And you know what? This is a hard concept to explain. And there are a lot of photographs of people who have the bikes. You can kind of see what the bikes look like. They don't look like everybody else's bike a lot of the times.
Yeah, it's true.
Because as people age, they ride the bike sitting differently.
Mm-hmm.
And we do not automatically fit you for a racing bike at Hubbub.
Well, yeah.
We find out what it is you want. We ask a bazillion questions. Well, you know that already.
I think, you know, not to take anything away from what you're doing, any good bike shop will approach it from at least from that perspective, whether they're selling stock bikes or custom bikes.
I hope so.
They, you know, if you go, I think we can safely say if you go into a bike shop and they're pushing you, no matter what, to a racing style
and that's
bicycle,
not what you want to do.
Right. Or then you're not in the right place, I would say.
Right.
So any decent bike shop is going to, you know, try and put you on a bike that
well, I
that
would do
works
my homework
for you. It fits your style as well as your size and your shape.
Well, there's a lot of unfortunate manufacturing going on right now that there isn't a lot of choice.
Well, yeah.
If you're looking at what's popular, if you're reading popular magazines or reading popular online sites, blogs, you're going to see a lot of carbon fiber. You're going to see a lot of
very small
racing
clusters.
Well, even if, the you know, SRAM has this new Apex group, it's inexpensive. It's fabulous. You know, it's a double crank with a big cassette in the back and great shifters. But you have to understand that it's a lot of it's just marketing hype. And we try to, even though it's custom and yes, it's expensive, we would love to sell less expensive bicycles if they were out there. If we could find the frames. And it all starts with the frames. Everybody hangs the same components on the
mm-hmm.
bikes. You're either
yeah.
buying Shimano, SRAM, or Campy. So, you know, all those things are equal. We've got apples and apples. But when you look at the frames that are available, you're either buying carbon fiber or a lot of aluminum, neither of which is necessarily suitable for the kind of riding our average rider rides. And I think I said last week on the show, our average rider rides 2,500 miles a year or more. And it's funny, when you talk to the people at all the manufacturers we deal with, especially Seven, they go, wow, your customers really ride their bikes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah.
And I know a lot of people who ride stock carbon fiber and aluminum bikes
right.
that far or farther. So, you know, it can
it
be
all
done.
Works.
And yeah, it all works. And
it's just the degree to which you want to be, you know, you want to take it. And so we take it to the nth degree, and we know we have a very small number of people who are going to do that. But there are only two of us. We don't have a big staff.
Yeah.
You know, we do it all together. It's just one fit. Well, we both facilitate the fits. He does all the designs. He does all the builds. We build all of our own wheels. You know that.
Yeah.
You know, we're a very, in some ways, we're a very traditional shop in this sort of.
Yeah, in a little convoluted way,
yeah.
I would say that. So I want to remind you very quickly, if you're just joining us, that this is a bit of an unusual Outspoken Cyclist this week. Normally, we have Diane interviewing guests from near and far about cycling, but this week, being New Year's Day and everything, we decided to depart a little bit.
No, Greg decided.
Okay, I'll take the credit slash blame for this.
Okay.
But we decided to have Diane be the guest and give you a little background about her. So Diane Lees is our guest today on The Outspoken Cyclist. Back to custom versus stock, the best bike for people, I think,
is the bike you'll ride.
That's right. That's right.
Whether, so I don't care.
However you arrive at it,
yep.
It's not the most expensive or the lightest or any of those things. It's the one you'll actually ride. And if it feels good, you'll probably ride it more.
It's insulting to us when people take a $5,000 bicycle home and put it in their garage and don't ride it.
Hang it on the hook.
Don't ever tell Brian you're doing that. He will come and take it away because his philosophy is, it's my bike, I just let you ride it. He's told that to people in the past. It's pretty cute, actually.
You know, Brian's pretty opinionated himself, and we're still working on getting him on the air.
He'll be on eventually,
as a guest.
I think.
Yeah, we'll wear him down in 2011.
But his opinions are well-founded.
Oh,
you know,
sure.
He has
sure.
this incredible understanding of the bicycle from the inside out. I've never seen anything quite like it in the 30, it's going on 37 years now I've been in the bike business.
Yeah. So Hubbub is still going strong?
Yeah, we are, although, you know, we're getting ready to change our model.
We're getting ready to move.
We are getting ready to move into a facility that will be finally, after 25 years, appointment only for sales.
And back to within
within a couple miles of the studio,
which was the criteria.
And originally was Hubbub was originally had to be within a mile of my house. Well, our new facility will be within 3/10 of a mile of our
house.
And part of that issue was when we moved out to Chesterland, which is, you know, not even in Cuyahoga County, which is the county in which Cleveland is located, and South Euclid, where we live. We also had a yoga studio built for us and a coffee shop. Well, I fell in love with the coffee shop, but the coffee shop didn't do well in Chesterland. It was just one of those strange combinations of circumstances and location and just the whole Chesterland way of dealing with things that made the coffee shop unsuccessful. Now, there are people who were just diehard High Peaks coffee fans. They just loved the coffee. And I do still sell some of the coffee beans that were roasted for us to begin with. Mm-hmm. We have several
blends.
Blends, thank you.
Yeah.
Hubbub blends, actually. But it will be strictly the yoga studio. I'm going to devote more of my time to teaching and a lot more time to the show, which it's just been the most incredible opportunity for me.
Yeah.
To do this to do this radio show. It's like the best. I'd like to do some work with other bike dealers and teaching them about my fitting techniques, which are very different from a lot of these computer programs and things like Retool. And there are a bunch of them out there now. FitKit is still around. It's in a different form. That was Bill Farrell out of the East Coast originally put FitKit together. I think actually Waterford uses a lot of the FitKit stuff. He has his own sizing machine. Serrata still has a sizing machine. Calfee has a sizing machine. We still use a Serrata size cycle because it's just what I was familiar with all those years. We've always talked about building our own sizing machine. That may happen now in this new facility because there are some things we'd like to do working with more power output and that kind of thing. But I just think our specialty is our understanding of somebody actually sitting on the bicycle and how that translates into what it is you want back from the bike.
Yeah, it's very important.
It is important.
Yeah.
So that's my whole bicycle life story, Greg. What can I say?
All right. Well, not much more to add than that, but we're glad to have you on the air here at WJCU.
And I'm glad to be here. It was an amazing opportunity, and it's because of you and Mark.
Yeah, we have to tip our hat to
Mark Krieger,
our general manager. And
who it turns out I knew anyway. which was even funnier.
Yeah, it's a very small world.
It is a small world.
And we've had, you know, what I would call tremendous response to this radio show and to the podcast over the last few weeks. So, you know, we definitely say Happy New Year and thank you for listening to all of our listeners. We know you are out there and that you join us on a weekly basis one way or another.
Well,
and
if people have questions about any of this stuff, they can just write to me at theoutspokencyclist@gmail.com.
Yeah, it's outspokencyclist, not right. No.
No. Oh, that's right. Not the. It's outspokencyclist@gmail.com.
Right.
I didn't put a V in there.
And I think we want, as we go along into this coming year, we hope that we have a little more interaction with listeners. We'd like to get, you know, some listener feedback.
Yeah, we can do questions. You know, if I can get a question in, we'll answer questions. We'll answer email. We'll answer text. So, maybe we should we do the Twitter thing? I actually am on Twitter at hubbub01.
Okay.
If you want to tweet. I thought that was the funniest thing I ever heard, Twitter. What a cool concept.
Well, we'll see. Cyclists are an unusual bunch. Sometimes they're just, you know, quiet and contemplative and reflective. They listen and
think. And other times they're nuts.
And they are. But, but in general, they don't seem to be too vocal.
Lance tweets.
Yeah.
To millions of people, evidently.
So hopefully we can get our listeners to engage with us a little bit more in the coming year. So.
All right.
That's very interesting, Diane.
Well, Greg, you know, you asked for it.
Well, I think it's important for people to have an understanding of kind of where people are coming from, what their journey has been, what their foundational attitudes are. So, because it really informs, you know, how you approach interviewing people and you know, dispensing a little advice and wisdom on the air. So good to finally get to know more about you.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity and. I hope it was a fun interview for you.
It definitely was.
Good.
All right.
Wow, we have actually, like, babbled for the whole hour.
We have just vaporized close to 60 minutes of time.
So I guess we have to say Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
And we'll see you next time.
Ride safely. Reset your cycle computers.
And you know who's on the show next week? Just as a tickler.
Okay, go ahead.
Gary Fisher.
Oh, neat.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, another big gun in the cycling business.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right.
Okay.
Take care.
Night-night.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.